It did not startle her. It seemed unastonishing and almost unimportant that at the end of the last sound she saw the door opening slowly without human touch, moving inward upon a growing strip of darkness. In the moment when an electric light went on inside the structure, he seized the knob and pulled the door shut, its lock clicking sealed once more. "It's a sound lock," he said. His face was serene. "That sentence is the combination of sounds needed to open it. I don't mind telling you this secret, because I know that you won't pronounce those words until you mean them the way I intended them to be meant." She inclined her head. "I won't." She followed him down to the car, slowly, feeling suddenly too exhausted to move. She fell back against the seat, closing her eyes, barely hearing the sound of the starter. The accumulated strain and shock of her sleepless hours hit her at once, breaking through the barrier of the tension her nerves had held to delay it. She lay still, unable to think, to react, or to struggle, drained of all emotions but one. She did not speak. She did not open her eyes until the car stopped in front of his house. "You'd better rest," he said, "and go to sleep right now if you want to attend Mulligan's dinner tonight." She nodded obediently. She staggered to the house, avoiding his help. She made an effort to tell him, "I'll be all right," then to escape to the safety of her room, and last long enough to close the door. She collapsed face down on the bed. It was not the mere fact of physical exhaustion. It was the sudden monomania of a sensation too complete to endure. While the strength of her body was gone, while her mind had lost the faculty of consciousness, a single emotion drew on her remnants of energy, of understanding, of judgment, of control, leaving her nothing to resist it with or to direct it, making her unable to desire, only to feel, reducing her to a mere sensation, a static sensation without start or goal. She kept seeing his figure in her mind, his figure as he had stood at the door of the structure. She felt nothing else, no wish, no hope, no estimate of her feeling, no name for it, no relation to herself. There was no entity such as herself. She was not a person, only a function, the function of seeing him. And the sight was its own meaning and purpose, with no further end to reach. Her face buried in the pillow, she recalled dimly as a faint sensation the moment of her takeoff from the floodlighted strip of the Kansas airfield. She felt the beat of the engine, the streak of accelerating motion gathering power in a straight line run to a single goal. And in the moment when the wheels left the ground, she was asleep. The floor of the valley was like a pool, still reflecting the glow of the sky. But the light was thickening from gold to copper. The shores were fading, and the peaks were smoke blue when they drove to Mulligan's house. There was no trace of exhaustion left in her bearing, and no remnant of violence. She had awakened at sundown, stepping out of her room. She had found Galt waiting, sitting idly motionless in the light of a lamp. He had glanced up at her. She had stood in the doorway, her face composed, her hair smooth, her posture relaxed and confident. She had looked as she would have looked on the threshold of her office in the Taggart Building, but for the slight angle of her body leaning on a cane. He had sat looking at her for a moment, and she had wondered why she had felt certain that this was the image he was seeing. He was seeing the doorway of her office, as if it were a sight long imagined and long forbidden. She sat beside him in the car, feeling no desire to speak, knowing that neither of them could conceal the meaning of their silence. She watched a few lights come up in the distant homes of the valley, then the lighted windows of Mulligan's house on the ledge ahead. She asked, "Who will be there?" "Some of your last friends," he answered, "and some of my first." Midas Mulligan met them at the door. She noticed that his grim, square face was not as harshly expressionless as she had thought. He had a look of satisfaction, but satisfaction could not soften his features. It merely struck them like flint and sent sparks of humor to glitter faintly in the corners of his eyes, a humor that was shrewder, more demanding, yet warmer than a smile. He opened the door of his house, moving his arm a shade more slowly than normal, giving an imperceptibly solemn emphasis to his gesture. Walking into the living room, she faced seven men who rose to their feet at her entrance. "Gentlemen, Taggart Transcontinental," said Midas Mulligan. He said it smiling, but only half jesting. Some quality in his voice made the name of the railroad sound as it would have sounded in the days of Nat Taggart, as a sonorous title of honor. She inclined her head slowly, in acknowledgment to the men before her, knowing that these were the men whose standards of value and honor were the same as her own, the men who recognized the glory of that title as she recognized it, knowing with a sudden stab of wistfulness how much she had longed for that recognition through all her years. Her eyes moved slowly in greeting from face to face. Ellis Wyatt, Ken Daniger, Hugh Axton, Dr. Hendricks, Quentin Daniels. Mulligan's voice pronounced the names of the two others. Richard Halley, Judge Narragansett. The faint smile on Richard Halley's face seemed to tell her that they had known each other for years, as in her lonely evenings by the side of her phonograph they had. The austerity of Judge Narragansett's white-haired figure reminded her that she had once heard him described as a marble statue, a blindfolded marble statue. It was the kind of figure that had vanished from the courtrooms of the country when the gold coins had vanished from the country's hands.
"You have belonged here for a long time, Miss Taggart," said Midas Mulligan. "This was not the way we expected you to come, but welcome home."
"No," she wanted to answer, but heard herself answering softly, "Thank you."
"Dagny, how many years is it going to take you to learn to be yourself?"
It was Ellis Wyatt grasping her elbow, leading her to a chair, grinning at her look of helplessness, at the struggle between a smile and a tightening resistance in her face.
"Don't pretend that you don't understand us. You do."
"We never make assertions, Miss Taggart," said Hugh Axton. "That is the moral crime peculiar to our enemies. We do not tell, we show. We do not claim, we prove. It is not your obedience that we seek to win, but your rational conviction. You have seen all the elements of our secret. The conclusion is now yours to draw. We can help you to name it, but not to accept it. The sight, the knowledge, and the acceptance must be yours." "I feel as if I know it," she answered simply. "And more. I feel as if I've always known it, but never found it. And now I'm afraid, not afraid to hear it, just afraid that it's coming so close."
Axton smiled.
"What does this look like to you, Miss Taggart?" He pointed around the room. "This?" She laughed suddenly, looking at the faces of the men against the golden sunburst of rays filling the great windows. "This looks like... You know, I never hoped to see any of you again. I wondered at times how much I'd give for just one more glimpse or one more word. And now this is like that dream you imagine in childhood, when you think that someday in heaven you will see those great departed whom you had not seen on earth, and you choose from all the past centuries the great men you would like to meet."
"Well, that's one clue to the nature of our secret," said Axton. "Ask yourself whether the dream of heaven and greatness should be left waiting for us in our graves, or whether it should be ours here and now, and on this earth."
"I know," she whispered.
"And if you met those great men in heaven," asked Ken Daniger, "what would you want to say to them?"
Just hello, I guess."
"That's not all," said Daniger. "There's something you'd want to hear from them. I didn't know it either until I saw him for the first time." He pointed to Galt. "And he said it to me, and then I knew what it was that I'd missed all my life. Miss Taggart, you'd want them to look at you and to say, 'Well done.'"
She dropped her head and nodded silently, head down, not to let him see the sudden spurt of tears to her eyes.
"All right, then. Well done, Dagny. Well done. Too well. And now it's time for you to rest from that burden which none of us should ever have had to carry." "Shut up," said Midas Mulligan, looking at her bowed head with anxious concern.
But she raised her head, smiling. "Thank you," she said to Daniger.
"If you talk about resting, then let her rest," said Mulligan. "She's had too much for one day."
"No," she smiled. "Go ahead, say it, whatever it is."
"Later," said Mulligan.
It was Mulligan and Axton who served dinner, with Quentin Daniels to help them. They served it on small silver trays to be placed on the arms of the chairs, and they all sat about the room with the fire of the sky fading in the windows and sparks of electric light glittering in the wine glasses. There was an air of luxury about the room, but it was the luxury of expert simplicity. She noted the costly furniture, carefully chosen for comfort, bought somewhere at a time when luxury had still been an art. There were no superfluous objects, but she noticed a small canvas by a great master of the Renaissance, worth a fortune. She noticed an oriental rug of a texture and color that belonged under glass in a museum. This was Mulligan's concept of wealth, she thought. The wealth of selection, not of accumulation.